Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
My name is Alan.
We are from ReverseThieves.com. You can go there to get all the previous episodes of the podcast. And this is month six of COVID, is it?
I was literally thinking as we were starting, as not even we were starting talking about the podcast, as we were like doing the, all right, 3, 2, 1, that it seems both simultaneously, like months ago that we did the last podcast and like only a few days ago, because my sense of time is, and my schedule of work is so weird that like, I have like both concepts of, it's been a really long time and it's been a really short time simultaneously in my head.
I totally get that. I feel exactly the same way. It depends from like hour to hour whether or not things feel long or short. And also, I mean, I don't think, you know, it's not very clear, obviously, because it's all happening on the back end, so it's not clear to listeners, but like, Al and I used to see each other a lot, like a lot, to hang out and just talk about whatever we're watching or, you know, it, our day or like, you know, just everything. And now, I mean, we text, but like we spend a lot more time before we're recording this podcast just like catching up because we are not like hanging out on the regular anymore. So I feel like, you know, it's just it's odd in just so many more ways than one.
I mean, we always used to just shoot the breeze and like almost warm up conversation before most podcasts, but it feels like we're trying to cram in more.
Totally.
Whereas we're kind of just like, we used to be a lot more easy breezy, unless like one of us had been on vacation or something.
And we would also, I feel like, obviously we could just talk to each other forever because, you know, we're besties, but like, we wouldn't necessarily have as much to say because we had like just seen each other probably like a day or two before recording versus now. So, yeah, so that's, but I feel like it also in ways has changed like the dynamics of recording the podcast because we don't get to talk as much about the things that we're getting ready to talk about. So like, there's like an element of surprise to the podcast now that wasn't necessarily present previously.
As we mentioned in the last episode, this is a little projects, like what have we been, you know, this isn't like a season review or new shows of the season or like a particular topic. This is just like, since we've had a bunch of free time, what have we caught up on in the meantime? But I feel like, to spoil one of the things we're talking about, you recently did a rewatch of Avatar and doing Korra. I feel like there's no way that you wouldn't have told me everything that you were going to mention in the podcast, but there's no way you wouldn't have had shared at least some distinct feelings. I would at least know one or two highlights of the podcast before we begin. But I literally did not know that Kate was rewatching Avatar other than like a few offhanded mentions of like, yeah, I think I'm going to rewatch Avatar. A lot of people talking about Avatar. I'm going to rewatch that. And I just like, when we talked before this, I found out, oh, Kate has finished Avatar. She's like, some amount into Korra, she's going to talk about it. She has feelings. Interesting.
I mean, let's just get into it then, since you're t you know you've given me a great intro to do so. So as Al said, and I think we talked about this like on offhandedly in a previous episode, that Avatar: The Last Airbender was put up on Netflix recently and it had this sort of resurgence, and a lot of younger people were watching it for the first time and people were just talking about it again. And then even more recently, Legend of Korra, the follow-up series, was just put up on Netflix. There's a recent novel that came out that's about Avatar Kyoshi. So, like, yeah, Avatar is, like, having a moment or whatever.
And apparently, like, Netflix wants to do, like, a live-action version of Avatar. And, like, and that's one of the reasons they put it up there in the first place.
And there was controversy about that because the original creators were on board to do that with Netflix, and they've now since left the project. So, like, who knows what exactly that's going to turn out to be. Yeah, so there's like, a lot of Avatar, you know, stuff going on. So, I had decided to rewatch it. So, like, a little background on that. Because I don't know if we've ever talked about Avatar on the podcast. Or, I can't remember.
We definitely talked about the first season of Korra. I remember that much, and we've discussed it offhandedly beyond that, but because I think it was like in the section that nobody ever got, ongoing investigations, I definitely think we did an ongoing investigations on the podcast about Korra.
That sounds definitely possible. So for the original series, I watched the first season, like, broadcast, and at least some of the second season broadcast originally. And then I think for, like, the third season and, like, the finale, I don't think that I did. I think I saw that, like, a little bit later. Avatar: The Last Airbender is about these two, well, it's about the four elements. And the four elements are the fire, earth, wind, and water. And then they're, you know, nations living in harmony until the Fire Nation attacks.
Kate, you're not doing the meme right. It's everything changed when the Fire Nation attacked.
I'm so sorry.
I know it's that line because people love to, like, that is a very popular meme of either, and then the Fire Nation attacked, or then, and then group or person X attacked. It's a very, like, people love to use that line.
And the only person in the world that is, like, supposed to bring balance to all four elements is the Avatar, who is reincarnated, however, they're not, like, immortal, so, like, whenever that Avatar dies, they're reincarnated in the next generation. And Aang, the Avatar of Air, gets frozen in ice, and he disappears for 100 years, until two young people find him in the ice. They break him out inadvertently, and then they kind of go on this quest to restore peace to the world and, like, take down the Fire Nation, like, the heads of the Fire Nation, as they have, like, now basically taken over the entire, pretty much the entire world. There's a few holdouts that are, like, relevant to the story. And the two kids that find him are from the South Pole, and they are trying to, you know, help Aang learn all four elements, yada, yada, yada. So it's, like, an adventure story. It's a journey. And it has, like, you know, just, it definitely gets into, like, interesting stuff about politics, about taking lives, you know, like colonization, you know, all kinds of interesting good stuff. And it's also, you know, it's taking different inspirations. There's definitely like anime influence on the series. There's also like each element's fighting style is based on a real style. So like the water is based on Tai Chi. So each of them kind of have their own style. And there are characters that kind of come in to create this like surrogate family of kids that have to, you know, be the generation that makes the change, basically. Like, they have to bring the change to the world. So, you know, those in the know who, like, really get it know that this show is actually called The Journey of Prince Zuko.
I was about to say, Kata showed so much restraint and not just pretending this is the Zuko show.
I was getting there. Stop. I was getting there. Okay. Like,
what do you call it? Co-starring some other chuckle fucks who come along for the ride. And I was like, all right, here's Kate on schedule.
Yes. So, like, the antagonist, or there's multiple antagonists, but, like, the antagonist, certainly for a good portion of the series, besides the head of the Fire Nation, is Prince Zuko, who is Prince of the Fire Nation, but he is a banished prince who is trying to restore his honor by capturing the Avatar and, you know, being cool. He doesn't do a real good job of that. Spoilers. And, you know, yeah, he's awesome. He's the best. And, like, it was interesting because I was rewatching this with Carl here at certain points, and we're both big Zuko fans, and I really liked Zuko of season one. He's my favorite version, because if you rewatch it, like, and I didn't necessarily remember this, but like rewatching it, I just like noticed it and it made me love him so much more, is that he literally yells every single line in the first season. Like, no matter what he's talking about, he is always mad, like always. And so like, he's always sarcastically yelling things every time like he has a line. But he like, yeah, I mean, he goes through a massive transformation over the seasons. And, you know, is a pivotal character in the story for good. And, you know, things that I noticed, I guess, obviously I'm not going to do like a review of the show, because like plenty of people have done that. And like, that's not really useful here. I just wanted to kind of revisit some of my feelings about the show. One of the things I really liked was, I mean, I really like Aang. As much as I just talked about how, like, Zuko is, in my opinion, the story, because he is. But, like, I think Aang, I just find him to be such a great character, because he is not, I think he kind of falls into that section of main characters that you are unexpected. Like, he's not, he's kind of a goofball. He doesn't actually like fighting. He is really like a gentle character, and, you know, certainly a bit unprepared for what is like this heavy burden on his shoulders, especially after like the previous king of the Fire Nation, you know, genocidally kills all of his brethren. So to kind of come back into a world like that and be so, to be able to be buoyant and to like believe in peace, to believe that death and violence is not the answer to that. You know, I like Aang is just such a is a really lovely character. And he has obviously some, oh my God, I feel like I'm quoting the entire like opening sequence. I was about to say he has a lot of growing up to do, but I believe Aang can save the world. So yeah, I think, you know, I think that, and then like the ancillary characters, like Sokka is an idiot, but he is very, like, he's not the type, like, because this is going to be relevant because I am about to talk about Legend of Korra and some problems. But, okay, so, like, Sokka is, he's a dummy-dumb, but he is also actually very smart. Like, he is really strategic, like, he is the strategizer, like, he does a lot of the planning. It's not like all of his plans go well or whatever, but, like, they really rely on him for certain things, even though he doesn't have the ability to bend.
I just want to interrupt for a second, because I feel like, and I've heard this from several people, the worst thing to come out of Sokka was not in the show itself, but it was the number of cartoons who took the wrong lessons from his character, because I feel like so many shows after Avatar, because Avatar was such a phenomenon in the American kids cartoon landscape, and a lot of them like took this, was it you or I forgot somebody who like described Dragon Prince as oops, all Sokkas.
I don't think that was me.
And then, like, I feel like a bunch of other shows have, like even Keith from Voltron. Not Keith,
Lance.
The other one. Lance from Voltron seems to be like, oh, let's just take this Sokka character and put him in Voltron and just turn everything up to 11. That's what makes it good. And from what I just understand, a bunch of other shows have tried that and, like, kind of missed, like, the balance you have to strike with that character.
I mean, it doesn't seem to bother other people as much as it bothers, like, me or you or, you know, some other people, because I think, like, those shows and, like, those characters are, like, very, very popular that you're talking about. So, like, I don't feel like everybody feels the same way. But, like, one of the things that I appreciate about Sokka is that even though he's not a bender and he can be, you know, he makes dumb jokes and whatnot, but he's not really, like, a liability. It's not like, oh, Sokka's always, like, messing up and getting them into like trouble or like being kidnapped or whatever. Like he's still like he is not a bender, but he shows his worth to the group like consistently.
Yeah, no, I when you were talking about his character, I had to bring up how much I feel like inadvertently he has affected the landscape. And I think the problem, or the thing is, like you said, that character is still a popular archetype, so people enjoy it when they put in other shows. What I was thinking of more is, like, more kind of mature reviewers tend to be like, all right, they brought back basically the popular Sokka type archetype, but this show doesn't know how to do it. So, you know, certain fans eat that up, but I feel like a lot of reviewers are like, oh, it's another badly done Sokka in this show. Fun, fun, fun.
And yeah, like, it's interesting because he is that has become like a trope. I kind of came back into regular Avatar expecting to really like dislike him because I dislike those later like iterations, but he is not like, yeah, it's like, it's almost a disservice to him, I think. So I thought that was very interesting. I love the ending of the series, like especially, you know, Aang's confrontation with the Fire Lord and like how that all works out. Like I just thought it was so great.
The only thing I wanted to also mention was I remember back in the day, and I don't know, as you said, you watched it with Carl. He definitely, me and him had a long discussion about this back, way back when it just came up about that ending. I feel like a lot of people either super loved that ending or thought the ending was a big cop-out.
Actually, I wanted to go back to something you had said earlier, Al, about Avatar being really popular, because I think that at the time, it didn't quite, especially the later season, did not quite find, like, they kept changing this time slot and there was like problems. So I think that it certainly, it had its fan, you know, like the fans were there, but it didn't necessarily, like, it's one of those things that I think was always good, but that didn't necessarily like hit all of the things that Nickelodeon was looking for it. And so I believe that, yeah, there was some like hemming and hawing around with the last season that, like, I do think that there are moments that they don't get to explore enough. And so I think that the reason I wanted to go back to that just for a second was that, like, tying that into like how they wrapped up the series. And I think that I like the answer there, but I wish that we could have had, especially more like spirit world stuff with Aang and like kind of that internal journey of like questioning his reincarnated selves and things like that. Like, there's just so many interesting points that get brought up in there that I do wish they could have explored more of.
I mean, they tried to do that in Korra. We'll get to that. But I do feel like, yeah, you feel like there's certain things that they do, especially with later seasons of Korra, that show that they realized that was a problem with the first Avatar, and they definitely try to explore that.
But I definitely do wish that was in there more, but I also wonder, just production-wise, if they were a little bit hemmed in by certain things that happened. So, but I think, like, the ultimate answer I thought was really great. I personally think that to me, the first season is actually the strongest. Like, I enjoyed the first, and maybe that's just because there's nostalgia there of like watching it. I don't know. I mean, I think other people would disagree and say that they think the second season or the third season is the strongest. But like, I like kind of like it when it's just earlier and they're trying to like figure things out. And like I said, Zuko in like first season is just like amazingly hilarious and wonderful to me. So I still think that, like, for me, that's sort of like the best part, but there's definitely serious things that happen later on that are really good. But there's also, like, I think in later seasons, I think in the first season, to me, there's only like one time-wasty episode. And then like seasons 2 and 3, I think, have more time-wasty episodes than the first season. So
what's the one with the two, like clans that are,
that's the first season. That's the first season.
I think that is like considered the worst, like the episode people hate the most out of the whole series, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think it has, it's like, has like, yes, high status as like the worst episode. But like, and it is, it's not a good episode for sure. But I think there's other episodes that are also, like, even if people enjoy them, they're weird and dumb and don't make sense. So, like, I mean, there's two beach episodes in the second... Wait, there's two beach episodes in the third season? Or maybe there's one in each, and both of them are just like, what is this? Like, what is happening?
So what you're saying is, maybe Avatar really is anime if they have pointless fan service beach episodes.
Yeah. I mean, the first beach episode is totally weird. It's this the weirdest, like, it's an alternate reality, I think. It's so strange. And then, like, by the second beach, I mean, the second beach episode actually has some, like, part of that episode has relevance to this season, but I was like, didn't they burn down this house in the first beach episode? So now proving that that episode never happened, I guess, because it was not real. But anyway, yeah, but, like, overall, I think the series is super strong. I think it totally holds up. It doesn't even feel old in any way. Not that it's that old, but, like, I think it makes sense to me that there's a lot of people discovering it for the first time and, like, really getting into it, because it almost just doesn't feel dated at all.
Yeah, I think they do a solid amount of world building, good character development. As you mentioned, a little rush in the third season, but overall, like, a nice flow of story.
And you'll notice that I have not brought up any shipping, because, boy, is that fierce. I don't particularly have any strong feelings about it.
Yeah, because I was like, when you were mentioning your love of Zuko, and then just all the Zuko shipping wars just popped into my head, and I was like, you know what, I'm not gonna bring it up unless Kate brings it up.
Don't really have, like, strong feelings about that, really. And I did appreciate that in the series in general there is, like, a little bit of romance, and then there's, like, a little bit more as the series goes on, but it's not really, like, a huge part of the story. So, you know, I like
that.
That's
not what the internet told me, Kate.
I mean, sure. But, like, I like that it's not as big, especially at the beginning. It's just not a huge presence. Or if it is, it's sort of jokey. It's not really, like, super serious or anything. And speaking of that, so, like, rolling that into Korra is so interesting, because... especially now, like, when I originally watched Korra, you know, I had watched Avatar, like, whatever. I hadn't watched it recently or whatever, so I just had my memories of it. But, like, watching them directly back-to-back has just highlighted so many things that I find really interesting. So, like, Korra, Legend of Korra is, like, really bold, in my opinion, for them to go to after the popularity that Avatar, like, generated and sort of, you know, I don't think you could call it, like, cult classic, but, like, it really found its audience and, like, continues to have such a huge fandom. And then, like, to make a new series, Korra, be so absolutely different, like, so different in so many ways. I just find that to be really bold. And,
So what you're saying is, since we brought it up before the podcast, it's really the Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey of the Avatar world.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel as if they almost, like, looked at their Avatar, you know, what they had done in Avatar, and were like, okay, like, what is the opposite of everything here? Or like, because, you know, Korra herself is the absolute opposite of Aang. The world, I think the world itself is the most bold thing that they did, because I feel like very few fantasy series would have the guts to, like, they didn't fully modernize it, but they, like, basically were like, this is a fantasy world, and now it's, like, in the industrialized, like, it's had an industrial revolution. And, like, to do that to their own world is, I think, just very unusual. Most people are like, you know, they want it to stay the time of whatever, you know, the original is. Not the time, but like the level of technology or whatever.
Well, I think it's smart because so much steam technology came out during the first Avatar, and it was all for like war purposes. But like, they wisely thought, why wouldn't the rest of the world then take this technology and now that there isn't war, use it everywhere else? Oh, by the way, people who are still into war are going to use it as well, but what do you call it? That's just the cycle of human civilization. War brings technology, it, what do you call it, goes everywhere, and then war picks it up again and takes it up another level.
So yeah, and so like that you know is very different from the original series. Also, like the original series is all about traveling and there's a journey and like you know it's constantly like moving. And then this, I think that might happen later, but like the first season is like in a city. It's like happening in one place. So like it's just so different, and like I think that the story itself comes off as more mature, and that's mostly because I think the characters are a little bit older anyway. There's also like useful and like present adults. Like in the original, there are adults and there are like good adults and stuff, but I think kind of their role in the series is a little more periphery than they are in Korra. Also, now I would say this is like maybe to a detriment in my opinion, but also, as I was just mentioning, the original series, I don't think there's a lot of focus on romance. There's a little bit of it, but like Korra like really comes out of the gate with like a lot of romantic elements to it. So yeah, I just feel like they just did the opposite of everything.
I mean, I felt like the first show was so iconic if they just had like Aang 2 in the world, but now Aang's a firebender. I think once again, bring up the Bill and Ted thing, I just in my head for a lot of reasons. Like, I think it would have easily gone down. I think it would have gone over a little better. But in the long term, not been as remembered. How well Korra is going to be remembered is, well, we'll see. Especially, I'm curious what you actually finish the series, what you think of it overall. But for better or for worse, it is not like, oh yeah, it's like that first season, but not as good.
Right. And but I mean, I didn't just think that that would be easy to do. And so yeah, so I feel like I remember originally starting Korra and thinking that it especially has a really strong first episode. And that definitely holds. It has like an incredibly strong first episode, and like even though I don't love like the pro bender stuff in these first half of the season, it's still like a really strong beginning to the series. And like kind of bringing in the equalist revolution and Aman as this charismatic leader and the idea of, you know, benders and non-benders kind of being at odds with each other because of bending versus like, it's like just an interesting evolution from the first series. So, yeah, I'm very excited to continue it, and I'm really glad that I'm getting back to it. And like, but you know, the original season, the original series is a hard act to follow. It is so, so good. It is so strong. But you know, there's so much that I really love about the Korra series. Bolin is not that part of that. So Bolin is the bad version of Sokka. Okay, he is an idiot. He consistently makes bad choices that put other people in danger and like force people to like save him. Anyway, that's what is that's what it bothered me about this show. I remember, so like I'm trying to just stay calm about it, but really watching it back to back again shows me like Sokka is like, I feel like that's what they're kind of emulating, but they're doing it wrong.
Man, all I have to say is, as someone who finished that series, I do not envy you guys having to get through season 2 of Legend of Korra, because that is without a doubt the low point of that series. But season 3 and 4 do so much to like, I'm basically encouraging you, go do so much to like take what seem like dumb plot points and themes and like, this is what we were going for. And you're like, oh, wow. Why couldn't you have had storytelling and thematic elements anywhere as good in season 2 as you did in 3 and 4? So, like, it will eventually be worth it because 3 and 4 not only are good in their own right, but actually retroactively improve season 2. So, it'll be a little tough to get through that season, but realize that it will eventually be worth it, and you shouldn't just like skip it and read a summary. Because
no, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I know. I'm more joking, but it will eventually have payoffs.
And the other thing that I, knowing what I, so knowing certain spoilers for the end of Korra, I will say that I do think I am curious to watch it to see sort of like when they pivot a bit, because I think that the first series, even though there were some production issues at the end, they basically, I think, wrote the whole thing and knew exact, like from the beginning to the end, like exactly what was going to happen. And we know, and like in Korra, at least in certain aspects of it, they absolutely changed courses. And so I'm curious to see how that evolves, because there are definitely things that they're setting up in the first season that it's like, okay, clearly you guys thought this was going in a different direction and that is not where it goes. And that wasn't like, oh, it's a red herring. It was like, no, you guys changed your mind. So, yeah, very, very, I'm excited about it. So,
I'm like assuming that you'll have the same opinion as me, which could be very much wrong, but I'm very much curious how much you think seasons 3 and 4, even though there's some rewrites and little, you know, definite course changes again, how much you feel it like plug some holes in 1 and definitely season 2. All right, so since Kate gushed about something, this is my turn to gush and fulfill a promise I made in an earlier podcast. So, I finished the new Shin Sakura Wars 6. At least, I played through one of the paths. I played through the main Sakura path. I decided to take a little break and then watch some other stuff, maybe go through Nodame and then go back and do the other paths. But they have a new game plus, so I'll probably be able to steam through the other stuff. But so yes, I finished, at least have a distinct opinion about the new Sakura Wars game. And on top of that, since I finished that, I went back and watched at least the first season of the new anime. If anybody's super curious, for like the one person who cares about Sakura Wars, I have not watched the new OVA for the mobile game because I don't know where it's subtitled. Because Sega put it out on their website, but it's only in Japanese. And so I'm kind of hoping somebody will fan sub it or somebody will pick it up. But if worse comes to worse, I'll just watch it on the Japanese YouTube and just, pick up what I can from context. But I have not watched that yet. I was definitely like super encouraged. As we mentioned in Otakon, there was that one Sakura Wars panel. So I really wanted to like finish both halves of that, both the anime and the game, for this episode. And so I liked both of them. And this is kind of a, I guess, at now we would call that a soft reboot. It occurs 10 years after the first five games. There was a big battle in which all the original members of all the three teams from the first five games, except for one character, fought like the Demon King, like the greatest demon, and they didn't defeat him, but they sealed him away, and none of them have been seen since. And since then, there have been some like minor demon outbreaks, and the current Imperial Tokyo Review has kind of become like the least powerful of all the anti-demon forces, and basically all the other countries are picking up the slack. And we start with this disgraced naval captain becoming like the new head of the hard-time Imperial troops and their rise back into relevance. And maybe that pesky Demon King coming back up. But very much the purpose of this game is to pass the torch. It's for the old companies to go, you are the new generation. Please go forward with our blessing. I mean, as I mentioned to Kate, the last chapter is called The Passing of the Torch. They could not be more obvious. I will say it did feel a little short. Like, it tells a complete story, but it definitely feels like the first chapter of a multi-chapter story, because minor spoilers, they just reseal the Demon King at the end of this. The other troops are still lost in Shadow Tokyo, although we've made some amount of contact with them. And literally the Demon King could come back at any time. But some progress has been made, and end of chapter one of this new era of Sakura Wars. And then, which, like, I felt was poorly telegraphed, the anime basically starts like 2 weeks later after the game and just kind of assumes you play through the game.
And also assumes that you know that like you
Yeah.
like
So, at least in Japan, they had a few months. I think they had like 6 months after the game came out for the anime. In America, the anime came out 2 weeks before the game came out in the US. And some of that had to do with COVID delaying stuff. But even then, they pretty much would have come out at the same time had anything gotten to the original schedule. Which is not that much of a difference, when push comes to shove. And so I also like the anime, but the more I watched it, and I asked some people online, and I got in contact with like some big Sakura Wars like mega fan, and like their answer was, I don't know, but part of me wonders if this anime was originally stuff that was supposed to be in the game that got like cut for time and then just put in this anime. Because Sakura Wars has always been envisioned as a multimedia project with like, multiple iterations all connecting and, you gotta buy a ball, Sakura Wars. So them planning a video game and then an anime afterwards is hardly out of the question. It's just when I was talking to Carl about it, he had mentioned that somebody felt like the game was like a little short and didn't tell a complete story. And I didn't have that feeling, but that was before I had watched the anime. And then I kind of was like, oh, I kind of can. The more I watched the anime, I more had speculation. So, like, there's one thing in the game, Sakura has a swordswoman teacher. And they specifically got the original persona, because all the main character designs in the game are done by Taite Kubo, the Bleach guy. But one or two key characters were designed by other people. The one woman from the original Sakura Wars troupe, they had the Oh My Goddess guy come back and age her up 10 years. And like one or two other characters were done by people. But her teacher, they got the persona character, the original persona character like, for like one, two, and three, I think. Not the later ones, but the original ones, to do her character design. And so like all the like guest character designs are really important characters, but overall, she basically just shows up, talks to you about Sakura, talks about Omo Rice, makes bad puns.
So she's your favorite character.
So I loved her character. Let's not, what do you call it? Let's not. But I was like, huh, weird that, like, I mean, she does give you a lot of, insight into Sakura, the main female character, by your conversations with her. So it's not like she does nothing but talk about Omu Rice and make bad puns. And they have like one or two little scenes that hint on her being like much more powerful and like a lot more than she seems, but she really doesn't do anything in the game other than give you those little insights and like, ooh, one or two hints that she's like much more powerful and cooler. The animation is crazy powerful, super integral to the story. She still remains crazy, mysterious, and will definitely tie into later games and anime. But you're like, oh, everything that like was barely hinted out in the game is crazy coming out. She's basically master Asia-ing people in combat suits and full-grown demons. Master Asia-ing, of course, for those who are not.
You don't need to, you don't, there's not a person on Earth who doesn't know what that means, Al.
Okay, I thought I might have to explain
No.
it. Then also the video you had your reaction, I'm like, ah, given our general people who listen to us, they're like, yes, of course I have watched G Gundam. What are you, an idiot? What do you call it? I have my, what do you call it, Domon. I'm currently, while I'm listening to you, drinking out of my Domon Cashew shot glass that I got with my limited edition G Gundam Blu-rays.
Did I mention, or did you tell me? I don't remember. There's like a Domon, like 1/8 scale like figure coming out, and I was just like, what did they finally get my memo? Like, what? Thank you.
So yeah, she's just like, once again, she's just beating down robots, beating down things. You find out all these, I won't even go into it, you find all of these crazy things about her. She's super integral to the story. She's basically, at the end of the anime, just might as well turn and go, see you in Secord Wars 2, bitches! Peace out! Zoom! So, and I was like, the more I watched, the more I could like go, all right, with a little modification, they could have put this part of the anime here and had these characters here. And like I could see where the parts of the, like it's obviously, if my crazy conspiracy theory is true, they do have to rewrite stuff with in the anime because it comes after the game. But I could pretty easily see how they were originally one story that got split into two because of constraints. And I do feel like, although I like both parts and felt they were fulfilling, I do wonder if the people who did feel the first game was a little thin and too prologue-y would have been happier if both of those things were in the same package, whether that was by time constraint or by design. Because like there's even parts where like there's a sixth room in the game. Like all the girls have rooms, and there's this sixth room that's never used. But there's a new girl who joins the troop that is only introduced in the anime. And there's the second floor to the building that always has this junk. And it's like the character wonders, ah, I wonder when they're going to remove this stuff. And it always feels like, oh, eventually this stuff is going to be removed. When we get, far enough in the story that there'll be other stuff that you can do on the second floor. But they never remove that junk. You never go to the second floor. But they totally use the second floor in the anime. And there are other little things, but those are like two like non-spoilery things that I can mention that like made me really think like, oh, those things all feel like stuff that got for time and they just move them into the anime, which is interesting. But yeah, I enjoyed them. I recommend them. I like the new team. I feel like The only criticism I will have is I feel like they took popular characters from the first five games and gave them all unique twists because it does really feel like, please love this new crew. They're kind of like people you liked in the past, but they're still their own characters.
Well, I mean, isn't that, that's the best, that should be the best thing, right? Like, at least they're not just copies of those characters.
I don't mind it, but I definitely clearly saw what they were doing. Of like, all right, we've tried to like have not the original Tokyo Revue twice, and people never like them as much. Like, maybe this will work. I've liked all the teams so far, so I guess I'm a pretty like underhanded pitch. But I mean, I recommend it. I will say, my greatest disappointment, and I know a lot of people, David mentioned this on the panel, is it's no longer a strategy game. They made it a lot more actiony, kind of a little more Dynasty Warriors-y. But I do feel like that does seem to be a. I've seen certain game franchises do that. If like they come back, they try to hook more people by having the game be a little more actiony.
Well, in this case, maybe that makes sense because their original audience seems to hate them no matter what they do. So maybe they're like, well, we need a new audience then.
Well, the old audience just wants them to keep remaking stories about the original Imperial troop, and what do you call it? Those other people can go in that fire over there and die. But yeah, I would just say I think it's best experienced with both halves, but I also realize that's a pretty hard ask to like play a whole game and then watch an anime after it to get like a complete story. And I know even in Corona times, there are people who ain't got time for that. So like if anybody's like, I ain't got time for that, more power to you. But I do feel like if you're interested, I feel like watching both halves kind of tells a more complete story, and I feel like you get a lot more out of it watching both of those together. Oh, one other interesting thing about the anime is the main dude character is hardly in that anime. He's like in the first episode, they have him come in like an episode in the middle, and in the last episode. And other than that, he's out doing investigation most of the other time, and it is everybody else in the games. Although it is not then just all the girls, because they do really play up the mechanic guy, who's the main character's best friend. So it's not like it's a total, like, no guys allowed, like only the girls, this little pink garden. But I did find it interesting that, like, Sakura super duper becomes the main character, not kind of a shared main character with the main guy being like kind of the protagonist and Sakura being the deuteragonist.
That's interesting because I wouldn't have guessed that from the first episode.
Yeah, like the dude, like, yeah, the dude was really in the first episode. He basically cameos for the rest of the series. Like, they have him go out and investigate in episode two, and he is gone for the most of the rest of it.
So even if, I mean, despite what other people might want to do or not, did you feel ultimately satisfied by, playing the game and then watching the show?
I think it tells a more complete story, and it feels like a little more of it feels more like a book one than a chapter one, which I think helps a lot. And that's why I'm like, if you could do it, I recommend doing them both, because I think that makes a much more satisfying package. Yeah, I was fine with the game as it was, but I think a lot more people would be satisfied with them both together.
So there's going to be another game.
This one did fairly well. And they just started a mobile game, but that one's like, I think, set in the modern day with like essentially like way past the original Sakura Wars timeline. So I feel like that essentially the mobile game just skipped so much time that they could still put out games in this time and still in the Taisho era and not bump heads with the mobile game. As I heard from that panel, the new game did fairly well, so I would suppose that they would do more of this. I mean, they as I said, the main teacher lady basically says essentially like, see you guys in the next Sakura Wars game. So Sega's always a little wonky, but nothing points to the whole series being canceled. That is as much as I know.
And are you going to try out the mobile game?
With my current plate, I will not try it unless they bring it over in English. It's not going to be like Grand Order where I played it in Japanese and still am playing it in Japanese. I mean, if you want, I can talk all about the Fate Grand Order 5th anniversary and really cool summer event.
Oh my God, Al, you have no idea how much I want you to talk about that. One last Sakura Wars question. Do you feel like people who have never played Sakura Wars, this is like an entry point for them?
I mean, oh yeah, no, definitely. The game definitely goes out of its way to essentially go, hey, you people who've never played one of these before, let us set up this world and go out of our way to, because they have a lot of references to the first three games. Anytime that happens, let us clearly explain to everybody who hasn't played those original five games what's going on here, so you are not lost. I feel like it's not like it is definitely not like the anime that's like, you played the game, so we don't gotta explain nothing. All right, let's just go. But yeah, going into the anime without playing the game is just dumb, because they make no effort. They just 100% assume you have played that game, and like, oh yeah, here's members of the Berlin and the London troops who you've obviously seen their whole story and character arcs in the game, so no reason to bring you up to speed about these guys. Or like, oh, here's the secret moon troop. We'll not even bother mentioning their names until halfway through the episode that they first appear in, because you obviously know them and what the moon troop is. Which did not exist in the original game, so here's a new, like, element to the Sakura Wars universe that even if you just played the original game, you would have no idea what it is. So yeah, You can play the game without playing the older games, but you cannot watch that anime without playing that new game.
Okay, so we're gonna travel back in time long ago to talk about some.
Cowboy
I
Bebop.
mean, sure. Okay, fine. Right. Let's change up this podcast. Wait, we've already done that pretty recently, actually. So.
Yes. I feel like when people talk about old anime, you can tell what era they could, like what era they start considering things old and what era they stop considering things old. And I feel like, I know we brought it up again, but I feel like you're going to be talking about a show everybody would consider old. But, like, there are people out there who are like, ah, this cake girl is going to be talking about a show from the 2000s.
We're going even further back in time before everyone even existed, I think. No one was actually born when this anime. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously, I mean, I actually was not born yet, but it's not that old. So I watched, well, I'll explain how much of I watched, but Six God Combination God Mars, which is a robot show from 81. And at least, in anime time, that's pretty old. And there's like so many reasons that I wanted to watch it, and there's also like just like some interesting history with it, but I've watched like about like 26-ish episodes of the series. So it's actually 64 episodes long because of course it came out in the 80s and it's a robot show, so it's more like just endlessly long. And then I watched the movie, which is sort of like a retelling of those kind of first season, I'm gonna call it. And then I also watched the OVA, which is like focuses on a secondary character and kind of tells their story, retells their story and changes it. It's like a different telling of their story, and then like up to a certain point in the series. So the if anybody knows this series that isn't just like a total robot nerd and that's why you know it. You might know it for its opening song because it has this like boop sound that like people really like. I don't know how else to describe it, but just go watch the opening on YouTube and like it will be stuck in your head. And the series is about Mars and Marg. They're twins who are separated, and they're both aliens from another planet, and like the evil emperor of that planet sends Mars sort of like as a sleeper agent to Earth and plans on him, like basically if he dies, basically he explodes and like it destroys the planet. But the like his father and like kind of had this other plan where like he sent these robots to Earth that help like protect him, and then like eventually like when he's like a teenager he like discovers all this and he pilots the robots, and then like he like defies the emperor and like decides to like fight the evil empire from space instead of like being their emissary. And then his like twin Marg is like on the other side, and he's like, there's like a, it's like a tragic family. Like, they want to be brothers and know each other, but they're like on opposite sides. And like, Marg gets brainwashed, and there's other things. And anyway, like, Marg is what matters, okay? That is all that matters in this show. So,
He's your Zuko.
yeah, yes. He's a tragic prince. And Also, this like, it's one of those series that has like really limited animation, because like the other power that people have in this series is like they can fight with their psychic minds, but like, you know, so it's just like it'll just be like, I'm fighting you with my mind, and then somebody will be like, ah, like electricity, you know. It's like, it's very limited animation, and like also like the robot like very rarely really moves or anything. And the series is, like I said, early 80s, 81. So it kind of looks more like a 70s, you know, like it has a, still kind of a 70s aesthetic to it because it's so early in the 80s. Especially like Marg and like his Bishonen-ness is like a very 70s style. But so the other interesting thing about this show is that in Japan, it is like, I don't know, recognized or like known for or whatever of being like a really seminal Fujoshi show. Like the brothers, the twin brothers, Mars and Marg, like incredibly popular. There was like a lot of like, you know, doujinshi of them, and like that was like a big thing. And like there was like some Japanese sites talking about like this is like a really important in the history of like of that, you know, fandom. So like the show itself is not really that good, guys. It's really not particularly good. Like I said, Marg is like the best and most interesting part. And the thing is that like you can kind of, you know, like it's clear that like when they were making the show, obviously it was, you know, about the robot and the toy or whatever, but like there was this popularity that came out of Marg especially. And so like he kind of leaves the series at a certain point, but then of course like they're like, well, shit, like obviously we need to bring him back in some way, you know. So like I feel like there's, you know, just like the it's so clear.
It was like we lost our whole female fan base in one second.
You know, and like there is a team. Like there's a team of people that help out Mars. You know, like the robot team or whatever, but like they don't matter at all, and like nobody cares. And they don't pilot the robots or anything. They're just like, there's like a, I don't know, they're like, they go, they're sort of scientists and, you know, or explorers, and so like they have relevance, but nobody cares. And so it's interesting that then, like, the OVA. So, the OVA is all about Marg. It's about, like, Marg's story and, like, from his view or whatever. But it's also, like, much later in the 80s. And so, it's, like, trying to be dark or whatever. Like, it's really boring, actually. But, like, they give him like a girl love interest who of course like totally gets fridged, and like there's just like a lot of stuff that they try to like, it's almost as if they didn't understand what everyone liked about Mark, but whatever.
Well, I mean, the problem was, like, I think only our oldest viewers will remember this, but I mean, you've already hinted at it, but I think it's worth iterating how much, like, you think nowadays how, like, oh, the dark, gritty reboot, or like the dark, gritty spin-off, but like, anime was doing that shite all the time in the 80s.
And 90s.
Like, how, of like, let's take this show that was popular, but it was for kids and we'll make it dark. And like, the one I always remember, which was the most egregious, was Gatekeepers. Not the original Gatekeepers was like this amazing show of quality, but like the amount that like sequel OAV just went super emo when it was otherwise like a light-hearted, dumb, fun show, was like, whoa, you totally just like threw out everything about the tone and aesthetic and storytelling of the first one. And that just happened a lot. So, yep.
Yeah, actually, the one that I always think of is 8 Man, where it's like, do you just go? Okay, if you've never seen 8 Man, the original 8 Man, just go and watch the opening, and then go and look at like it's like either 80s or like early 90s OVA for 8 Man. Just do it anyway. So like, yeah, so it, like the Marg OVA for Godmars is like. It's just like, it's not like, I mean, never mind. Yes, it is. It is totally that. I think there's some nudity in it. Like, it's just, and it's just not good at all. And then, so then I also watched the movie. And so the movie is like the retelling of like the first, what I would say, like the first Marg arc, basically. So, like, finally they get it. Like, this is what we're here for. And so like it's a bit of like a highlights kind of reel of and some small changes. And like unfortunately I think some of the things which consistently happen I think in you know kind of compilation movies is like when you have the context of the TV series you can kind of fill in certain things that get cut. But like if you just watch this movie I feel like certain characters' motivations are just like a lot less clear. Because it's like, what? Like, why did they decide to do that? So, like, the movie is also kind of weird. Also, the movie, like, the way it ends makes it seem like they were gonna do like another movie to like finish this. I mean, it has its like its arc, but it's not like the end of the TV series or something. So, like, I don't know. I guess it wasn't didn't do. I don't know. Whatever. They never made another one. So, like. Sort of, I guess, but also again, we only care about Marg, right, everybody? So it doesn't matter. But yeah, so I think it, I mean, it's interesting. It was interesting to explore, and I like going back and watching, you know, just like series that have some sort of cultural meaning that is not necessarily as important in the American fandom, but has like serious implications in Japanese fandom. So yeah, so even though it's really, you know, it doesn't hold up as like some really great show, I think it was worth, you know, kind of exploring a little bit of it. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend people go watch it, but I think looking up some information about it could probably be interesting.
So I assume you have no interest in finishing up the rest of the God Bars.
Yeah, I probably I'm what I might do is watch the last like 10 episodes or so where, you know, where it will get back to being like more focused probably. Just to see sort of how they bring back Marg because they will and just to sort of see how they kind of yeah, finalize it. But yeah, he is a beautiful 70s Bishonen. So if that convinces anybody, I mean, that was the reason I wanted to watch it. So.
It gives you the best reason to watch. I will also talk about an old robot show that does not have a Bishonen protagonist at all. I feel like the main character was a bungle. Nobody is like that Bishonen. I mean, somebody out there probably finds him hot, but Bishonen is not the title people would use for him. So try that, you know. I still have two main robot series to go. After Nodame, I'll probably go back. Like, I literally have no idea where I left off in Dunbind, so I think I'm just gonna have to restart that from the beginning. But and then someday I'll just put that gun in my mouth and pull the trigger on brain powered, but not today. But I watched The Bungle because I feel like a lot of even people we would consider old timers really speak highly of The Bungle as like the Tomino show that is one of his best that most people don't talk about. Like, you know, people will talk about the original Gundam, they'll talk about Zeta, they'll talk about Turne, you know, King Gator definitely has its popularity. Edeon, you know, has its weird reputation. But, like, they're usually like, if you want the show that's really good by Tomino that no one talks about, it's Zabungle. So that intrigued me, if nothing else, that it kind of had, like, this old man in the know. And just as a quick story, it's on this very desert planet. It almost feels like it could have been like one of the Space Cowboy trilogy of, you know, that was originally Cowboy Bebop, Outlaw Star, and Trigun. Because it almost takes a place on like a Trigun-y planet where, you know, it has like an Old West feel, but they're robots. And the weird rule of this world is if you commit a crime and get away with it for 3 days, basically the statute of limitations has passed and nobody will chase you or seek revenge. And the main character starts out, his family is killed by this one guy, and 3 days has passed and he still wants revenge, and he's still gonna get and everybody's like, but dude, they killed your parents 3 days ago, over 3 days ago. And he's like, yeah, I don't care. I lost my parents, I'm gonna get revenge.
Is this planet The Purge? Like, I feel like you must have told me this before because it sounds familiar, this like concept.
And it turns out that there's like this the civilians, which are the race that kind of live like old Western people with Mecca, and then there's this elite class that has like super high technology, and they live in these domed cities. And oh, I'm sorry, the people who live in the domed cities are the civilians. And so eventually Jiro realizes that the people who killed his family work for the civilians, and so then he starts like a war on the civilians as well. And he has this, like, he eventually gets involved with the scavenger group who then try to steal this one trading ship. And both of those teams eventually form together after the captain of the trading ship is killed and his daughter takes over. And by the way, the original name of the captain of the trading ship that ships things and sells them back and forth, his name is Carrying Cargo. Definitely show you go that this show is in fact the Tomino show. And his daughter is Elchi Cargo. So, and part of me just wonders if Elchi is some like Japanese pun. Like if I spoke more Japanese, I'd be like, oh, I see, carrying cargo and LG cargo. But I do not know enough or any Japanese to know how that, if that pun exists, what it is. But this is definitely one of Tomino's like comedy shows, but it's also, it's not Elgin, where like it'll shift between comedy and high drama within the same episode. Sometimes multiple times back and forth, giving you this weird mood whiplash. Like, the comedy episodes tend to stay, tend to be the comedy episodes, and the serious episodes tend to be the serious episodes. And most of the episodes are comedy episodes, but it's not as well blended as, say, Turn-A or Overman King Gainer, but it works. Like, he at least separates it well enough that it doesn't utterly like ruin the tone like it often does in Elgin, which definitely helps the show out a lot. Yeah, it's about 80% goof-a-doof, 20%, especially if like anything seriously with the war on the civilians happens. That really like brings in the high drama, but they then tend to cut down, or they'll just have like one little comic scene, but they won't have like half the scene is, you know, the crew doing stuff, and then oh man, everybody in this dome died. I will say they do have what, maybe one or too many comedy episodes at the end when they're like totally like kind of kicking the main drama story, and then weirdly the end switches back to total comedy after all of that, to the point where like the guy who kills Jiro's parents just basically gets a bot, like a basically Wile E. Coyote gets blown up and then is smoking and runs away. And they're like, we'll get it one day. And I'm like, wait, why did we just have this huge war with the civilians and major deaths and like the passing of the torch to the new inheritors of this planet, and then do that? So it's not in any way perfect, but the balance is better than some shows. It's definitely a fun experience overall, other than the fact that the ending goes most like comedy. There is a weird thing where Elchi, so like the main characters are Jiron. Jiron is the main guy, and then like the two, I'd say deuteragonists are Rag and Elchi, who both kind of like Jiron and are against each other and kind of vie for power over control of the ship. And so for the first half of the series, that's the general flow. And then Elchi gets kidnapped by the civil, like the bad civilians, and brainwashed, and spends most of the rest of the show fighting the main guy characters. And I expected that to go on for like a few episodes, but they don't get her back till pretty much the last three episodes. And even then, it takes a while for her to like fully reintegrate with the crew. So I was not expecting her to like totally switch sides and like spend like the last half of the series, considering how important she was in the first half, as a bad guy. But maybe, and Kate, you might already have this thought in your head and just be waiting to speak. It is Tomino, so I guess maybe if I thought about it objectively, a character changing sides for a long period of time is hardly un-Tomino-like.
I feel like at least they gave her a good reason.
Yeah, I mean, at this time, at least she was kidnapped and like several intense episodes of
Are you
brainwashing
sure she
before they
just
brought
didn't
her
have
back.
woman feelings? Like some really strong woman feelings?
No, they actually they show you how they slowly and actually use proper they also use wacky machines and stuff, and there is some wackiness, but they actually also, scarily enough, use real world brainwashing techniques of hey, mention three good things about your old people and maybe one good thing about the civilians. And she was already kind of like a civilian otaku before that. So, Tomino actually seemed to try to give it a decent amount of relevance, and it wasn't just that her lady parts made her switch sides, because that's how ladies do things. And they actually legitimately get her back, although her love for Jiron is also instrumental in undoing the brainwashing. So don't think that Tomino totally, is breaking his, signature style. But she does try to kill him many a time before that point. There is also an interesting whole subplot where they team up with this organization called SALT, who's like the main anti-civilian group. And their leader is interesting because he has noble intentions, but he's also very clearly a glory hound who's maybe not the best leader. And half in it for really noble and good reasons, and half in it for super selfish and dickish reasons. And I thought that was interesting of not making him like a total villain or a total hero. But kind of a very realistic kind of revolutionary guy. Although that group has also played for jokes a lot.
So what do you think it is about the series that stands out to the people who are, like, oh, it's the hidden gem or whatever?
So I feel like it's probably the first time that Tomino decently mixes comedy and drama. He does it with the series that he mixes it better. He does it much better later on, but I feel like this is the first time it's acceptable. L. Gein tries to do the same thing, and even though I enjoyed that, it really comes off as messy, and a lot of episodes will sabotage both feelings of having the main character in that be goofy and then murdering motherfuckers and to the point where other characters are like, whoa, what are you doing? And then going in the next scene back to comedy, like nothing happened. And that happening all the time. At least they segmented a little better, except for the, I'd say the ending. The world is very interesting. It's not like it has like this interesting kind of post-apocalyptic desert world. The whole thing with the civilians and the desert people and has an interesting dynamic once you learn like what the civilians are trying to do and like why they implement a lot of the laws they do and kind of the two different factions in their thing. And I do feel like, especially if you're into Tomino, and considering like the I think this was the series after Ideon, like I felt like it feels like a nice.
Oh, you mean that comedy, that rom-com?
Yeah, that that feel good laugh a second rom-com. I think also if you had been just watching his shows, I felt like it felt like a good break and change and like if you try to do like a Ideon the second, like there would just been braids. I think it was like in between Dunbine and Ideon, if I remember correctly, which are both shows that definitely cement the kill 'em all Tomino name. So I mean, yeah, it definitely feels like a breath of fresh air if you're watching his shows sequentially. The other random thing, this has nothing to do with your question, but it just popped into my head. The Zabungo basically is only the robot they use in the first half, and then they get like a better robot in the second half, and that's the one that the main character uses all the time. And it's like secondary, like loser characters get the Zabungo from then on, which is so weird for the titular mecha.
That's really interesting.
They'll be like, oh, Rag has to like go out and or and save Giron because like Elchi had too cunning a plan. I guess she'll use the Zabungle or even one of the lesser crew members has to pilot. I guess you could use the Zabungle. It's just sitting there. I feel it has to be mentioned because I can't think of any other series where like the what do you call it? The titular mecha becomes the teenager ride as opposed to the main character ride.
So, where would you say Zabungle ranks for you?
It's hardly my favorite. Like I said, some of the tone stuff at the end hurts a little bit, and I feel like Turn A and Overman King Gynor do the mixture of drama and comedy so much better. But I'd say it's a good but not a great Tomino show. I feel like it's another one of those shows like the oldsters hyped up more than what I feel I got, but I wonder how much it felt like so different just having like a space western feel when that wasn't really something that happened a lot, that it was like, once again, like one of the first successful Tomino outings where he mixed comedy and drama well, or at least adequately. So it is a watchable one, but it's not like I wouldn't make it your first or like one you have to go out and see. But it's definitely enjoyable. The crew banter is fun. It's fun to see Ataru's voice actor played one in like The Crew. It has some good comedy moments. It has some intriguing world building, but yeah, I list it as a good but not great total.
So, continuing on our like journey to the past, I also rewatched the Here Is Greenwood OVA from it's very early 90s and it's based on the manga, which is primarily an 80s manga, but I think it did run a little bit into the 90s. And this, I mostly had to watch it because I actually brought it up, I mentioned it in the last podcast when we were talking about Sing Yesterday for me. I just, happened to reference it and I was like, man, I haven't seen that in so long. Like, let me just go and rewatch it. And if you weren't a fan in the 90s, you might not know how like kind of ubiquitous I think that OVA was. Like a lot of people watched it. It was just something that, it was pretty short, so it was like fairly accessible.
As someone who used to work at a video store, I know it was very popular at video stores. And the video store I worked at, it was frequently taken out. So I think it helps that it was like it was definitely one of the anime that like a lot of video stores, like Blockbusters and Hollywood and Captain Videos, really liked to put in. So I think that also helped it a lot.
Yeah, and that's totally how I saw it. So yeah, if you were a person who was like renting anime in the 90s from places like that, I think again, like Al said, because they had decided to carry it, just a lot of people ended up seeing it because, the selection was pretty limited if you were renting. So yeah, I feel like I had seen this multiple times, in the 90s and it, I own it, so I was like, let's, revisit it.
Also, it was popular for people to rent at the stores because it wasn't a lot of episodes, so there was a good chance that all three VHS copies would be in. Because a lot of problem with the longer series is a bit, like one of them would get lost, and so you'd be like, "Yeah, do I want to watch it?" Like a, if they don't have like disc, tape four.
Oh man, I'm like getting all this like nostalgia memories of like renting anime in the 90s. I just have like so many feelings right now.
I feel like I want something to come out of the few years that I worked at a video store, so I'm using it, God damn it, so that weren't wasted years of my
No,
life.
they were absolutely not. It's important to have video store knowledge, okay? Because it doesn't exist anymore. It's very special.
It teaches you how much, like, returns just teaches you to hate other human beings to a level you do not understand, and to have other human beings hate you.
For those like unfamiliar with Here Is Greenwood, it's, I think again something that's interesting about it that I hadn't considered initially when I had watched it, of course, because I wouldn't have known this, and then it's only clear to me now. But it's as mentioned in the when I was talking about Sing Yesterday for me, it's an It's really for fans of the manga, which at the time that it came out in the US, this OVA, we didn't have access to that manga. And so it tells like a bunch of little like vignettes in the very beginning of the story. It tells a couple of like super popular little mini arcs from the manga, and then it tells you like the big romance arc from like close to the end of the series, and that like that's it in its six episodes. But something that was clear to me when I was rewatching it now was I think I'm saying this without like 100% knowing, but it occurs to me that it might be really, really important in the, like, how many shows do you have now of like cute boys doing nothing? Like, this series is, you know, four cute guys living in dorms and basically like fucking around for, you know, like getting into like just like misadventures. Like, there's a little bit of like more like, you know, like heartfelt stories at times, but like it's mostly like a comedy and like, you know, like, it's just like, I feel like it must be really important for like so much stuff that came after it. So the, you know, rewatching it now, it kind of occurred to me something else that I did not remember from initial watches is that, so there is one of the characters has this sister who is his rival, and like she super hates him and she's always like trying to get back at him and like whatever. She's like a very like an Ojo-sama sort of character, and she has the laugh and, you know, whatever, she's crazy. But in her like you know, remember, this is a comedy, like she tries to seduce a 13-year-old, and I was like, oh wow, hey, this totally reads a little differently now like while I'm here now, because she's not a teenager, she's like an adult person, so like, or seemingly pretty adult, like she's not in school, so I like assume that she is an adult and she has like henchmen and stuff, but like, yeah, she's like kidnaps a 13-year-old and then like tries to seduce them. So
I mean, Kate, if you want to lie to yourself, you could, like, it could be one of those things where she's like, because their family is so super rich, she could be like the high school girl who still has goons, kind of like Mendo's sister in Lum. And then it's just a high school girl trying to seduce a junior high school boy, which is like definitely far less creepy.
Yeah, I guess that would be better. Maybe I should. I definitely. It just like came off real different. I mean, she is supposed to be horrible, so like, I guess that fits. Like, anyway, it's supposed to be like, isn't that hilarious? And you're like, actually, no. Like, other than that, like, strange episode. You know, it's just like, it's a lot of just, yeah, you know, no like huge important revelations happen. Like Hasakawa does like move on, because, you know, he originally like goes to the dorms because he's heartbroken, and so like he does, you know, he does have an arc of like change over the course of the manga, so it's not simply like nothing ever changes or anything type of series, but it still has a lot of like, most of the stories are just like a wacky thing that happened at the dorms. Hey, remember that time where Mitsuru got haunted by this teenage ghost girl, and everyone in the dorms was just like, hey, could you just like take care of your ghost, and like has no, like, it's just like completely accepts that this is a thing that is happening. Or like, hey, remember that time where we all decided that our school festival, like, entry for this contest was going to be like, we're going to make a movie, and it's called, you know, like, Here is Devilwood, and it's a fantasy, and like...
I think the thing I always remember from that episode is at the very end, that other just, like, little bonus of redoing the Castle of Cagliostro
scene. Oh, so good! So, it's like... I love the creativity also of like that class of like how to reenact that. It's just like, oh wow, that's like, that's some innovation right there. Yeah, but I think it was like it was interesting because I feel as though if somebody were to watch it now who have never seen it before, I actually think that it would come off, like the humor I think is still there, but I think it would come off as a little slower paced than like a modern comedy series. I think that would be noticeable to people.
I would feel like the first episode comes out amazingly frantic at the rest of the series. Because they like try to do all that intro in the first episode before they get into the plot. And I feel like that always came up as very frantic to me. But everything past that like initial introduction to the plot, I would agree with you 100%.
And I think there's like, yeah, it's just so, it's not like a bad thing, but I feel like its wackiness is a little more subdued than like what you would expect from a wacky series now. And of course I would never have thought that, like the way that you would describe the show at the time, you know, would be like absolute hijinks, like, and it is, but it does have a little bit of a different pace to it.
But it's definitely, it's not like one of those total like slice of life moe cute boys doing like where like nothing happens and that's like the point, like to nigh healing anime levels of Pishu.
Right. No, I mean, this is supposed to be a comedy. And, you know, and you get a little bit of romance, like, here and there. And I also, like, really, I like the romance in this story. I mean, in the manga, too. But, you know, like, I like all that. Also, I mean, like, look, if you're going to put in some ex-delinquents, you know you have my vote. Obviously, everyone should know, should be able to figure out in this series who is my favorite boy. And so, like, yeah, it was really fun to revisit it. It made me want to reread the manga because this is sort of like a highlights reel. And they make reference to that even in the OVAs. They're like, ah, you don't know what happened. It happened in volume 2 of the manga, like, and stuff like that. So, yeah, and I don't know. I was thinking that this would be a great pickup license for Discotech. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if the DVD for this is still available. I think it might be out of print. Unless like Funimation or somebody picked it up, because it was originally like a Media Blasters release. Yeah, but I think this would be a great Discotech release. I would certainly buy it again because my DVD is old enough where you're like watching it and going like, wow, is this a VHS tape? Like, this is, the quality is really low. But the manga is available. It's available digitally from Viz. I was actually just checking because I was like, man, I should maybe pick that up digitally. So that is available if I have piqued your interest at all. So definitely like a recommend. So
one quick question, talking about how well things have aged and stuff. How do you feel that Shun ages?
I mean, Shun is totally comfortable in himself, so you know there's the initial like kind of like, oh, we're gonna trick Hasukawa about Shun, but like I don't know, I think Shun seems fine to me. I'm open to other people's opinions about that, but
no, I just like I feel like I didn't feel like he aged poorly from the last time I've seen it, but I thought it was worth bringing up, especially since you just rewatched it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they, like, obviously Shun is super Bishonen and gets mistaken for a girl a lot in the series, but, like, Shun, like, I don't know, Shun is just himself, so, like, I don't think that, I don't think it comes off as negative or anything. Also, I have to wonder how many, like, Shun Hasakawa shippers there were, like, versus, oh, wait, there's like, there's, you know, there are girls in the series, so, again, maybe would be different if it came out today.
But, Kate, did you ship the other two roommates?
Oh, Mitsuru and Shinobu? Like, I mean, they ship themselves, but, like...
They come and... I mean, doesn't he, like, ask, if he needs somebody to help him pick over the shrine at the end?
I mean, yeah, like, I don't remember that, but, like, yeah, there's definitely, like... There's a moment where, like, they say, I love you to one another. And then there's also, like, there's, like, the whole, like, there's, like, a moment where the ghost, in the ghost episode, where it's, like, the ghost has to kiss Mitsuru, but she can't kiss anybody because she's incorporeal. So she needs to, like, take over someone's, you know, someone's body in order to kiss him. And then it's like, well, who here has like a connection to the spirit world? And it's like, oh, obviously Shinobu. And so it was like, oh man, are they gonna like make this happen? And of course, like, it doesn't happen, but like, again, it's like teased. So, but yeah, I haven't also reread the manga in a long time, so like, there could be more stuff in there, which I like probably is. Yeah, but it is also, yes, it's from like the late 80s, so it's not exactly like, oh yeah, that's canon, you know, it's more of the like teasing it out sort of stuff, so.
Well, yeah, no, I have always loved that series. It always has always has a special place in my heart, so I'm glad to see it still holds up. But I did want to talk about one show that is the least detective related in this thing. So I went back and I finished case file number 221, Kabuchiko, basically that reimagining of Sherlock Holmes that we had both started a while back. And in the before times, no less.
Yeah, I only got about halfway, so I'm excited to hear what you think of the second half. Because it definitely has like two halves.
So, the story is kind of like in an alternate Kabuchiko, where like, Kabuchiko kind of has like an east side and a west side that's split by a wall. And this is never fully explained why it is. But so it just basically makes high-end Kabuchiko and low-end Kabuchiko. And Sherlock was once a member of the high-end who now is kind of a detective in the low-end. And, he is, goes to this one bar where a bunch of other famous Japanese and Western detectives hang out, and they solve this one, club owner, will give them jobs and they all compete or choose not to compete depending on what the case is, to solve mysteries. And in the first episode, Watson is involved in this case that he believes that only Sherlock can solve. So he goes to the low end side and tries to get him to come back to the high end side and solve the case, but like in the process winds up being his detective and hope his assistant and living with him in hopes that he'll eventually come back with him and solve this murder case. And that's pretty much the plot of the first half.
Well, but the first half is centered on Jack the Ripper.
Well, yes. Turns out that Watson's case eventually ties into the Jack the Ripper case. So, but yes, but you are correct. That is actually a better way of putting it. That there's also this Jack the Ripper case that is kind of going around in the background, but is always present. And so, for the most part, and I'm sure you'll comment to this, it's a lot of like, oh, and in this thing, Sherlock loves to do his denouement in, what is the name of that art form?
Rakugo.
Yeah. He likes to do his daemon in Rakugo because he wanted to be a Rakugo comedian and never succeeded and instead fell into being a detective and decided to mix the two. I'm not sure you got up to this part. But eventually you find out that the person who convinced him to do this is his friend and kind of not full assistant, but kind of associate, a one James Moriarty.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, obviously this retelling is very different in lots and lots and lots of ways, but I think Moriarty is, and sort of his role in the, at least in the first half of the story, is, you know, significantly surprising, I would say.
So yeah, a lot of the episodes are very silly, like kind of goofy takes on, original Sherlock Holmes stories with a little bit of Japanese and or Rakugo or just weird comedy twist. And that's like 3/4 of the first half. And then near the end, especially when the Jack the Ripper case happens, like most of that comedy is dropped. And things get like really serious really quick. And then that case ends. And I feel like how that story ends is kind of divisive. And easily could be seen as problematic at points. And not without any reason. And then the second half does a lot to recontextualize a lot of what happens in the first half, especially with Moriarty and what his role and motivations and a lot of his character, and the comedy kind of comedy to drama goes back and forth a lot until the end pretty much is like the end of the first half. Where like after a point basically there's no more comedy episodes and it's all the big climax.
I mean, like, how much would you say in the second half? Because, the first half does have some, like, a bunch of smaller mysteries. I mean, some of those end up tying into the Jack the Ripper case in different ways. But, like, how much of the second half is, like, a similar format?
So, I'd say there's basically two types of episodes in the second half. There'll be, let's look at one of the other detectives. And those stories will be a little more comedy, although one or two of them, especially the one about Mary and the other Marston that explores their dynamic, is a little bit silly, but gets really serious at the end. It's like the ones that have to do with the second main plot are mostly super serious, and the ones that deal with the other detectives are silly. The one with Mary is kind of almost like a fake out because you think it's going to be a silly episode, and it mostly is until the very end, where you learn, no, this isn't a silly learning about Mary episode. This is actually one that ties back into the main plot and then like swerves into, but it feels deliberately like they showed you a formula before that point of, oh, it's about this detective, so it's going to be a silly one. Oh, this is about a killer, so it's going to be, or a serious criminal, so it's going to be about this one. Oh, it's about Mary and her sister, so it's a silly. Oh no, it's actually one of the real ones. It swerves into that one, and I think that one was supposed to deliberately break the formula. The ending is either powerfully emotionally or anticlimactic, depending on how you view it. I feel like there's a big finale, and then there's two episodes after that where the next episode of that seems crazy dramatic. And then builds into the second episode, and I feel like I could. I don't want to give any spoiler ways, but I feel like there are a lot of people who are going to feel like it's a very soft but emotionally resonant ending, and a lot of people who are going to feel like it's crazily anticlimactic. And I'm not actually sure which way I feel about it. I almost have both feelings about it simultaneously, so I can easily see how people would fall into either camp. I don't know, it's definitely an interesting take on the Sherlock concept. I wonder how much I'm judging it softer, just how many bad ones we've seen recently of like anime that try to do their own quiz case take on Sherlock Holmes, and they've just been wretched. And so, like, since this one at least was good at times, part of me wonders if I'm just like grading on a curve too generously, or if it did have interesting points. Like I said, I feel like the resolution to that Jack the Ripper case can leave a very bad taste in certain people's mouths, and I don't understand why.
I mean, I think not even just the resolution of that case, but also like some of the sexual dynamics in the series. Like, I think that there's like certain things that are played for comedy that I, you know, it just doesn't really land very well in a modern like context, like where it's like, oh yeah, I would expect that in certain, like at certain times, but like right now I'm just like, no, like, but then it's weird because it's like, sometimes I feel like it's very progressive. And then sometimes I'm like, you're playing that in a way that feels really like detrimental. So it's very, I feel like it's a little all over the place.
It's a cross-dressing bar. And at times, like Kate said, at times, and there are definitely points of the story where they're extremely sympathetic to Miss Hudson, who runs the bar, and like, and other times she is definitely the butt of jokes. And so your mileage will vary very much on like your tolerance of like the respect to like punchline nature of all of that. And like I said, also like the resolution to the Jack the Ripper case, I think might even offend some people more. Like, just bad I feel like, all right, bad comedy from another country that like doesn't have our sensibilities, I'm not loving it, but I do know some people were very much turned off by how that Jack the Ripper case ended. I feel like that could easily, that really isn't as much of a problem in the second half. I feel actually they're a lot more respectful to Miss Hudson in the second half. I mean, it still pops up every once in a while.
Al, when you were saying before, I'm very curious about this and makes me kind of interested in watching the second half, is you said it recontextualizes a lot of things that happen in the first half. Do you think it alleviates some of the problems?
I will say no, because most of the recontextualization, that character gets a little recontextualized, but more about other things. Like, it's much more focused on other characters in the story. They kind of get dragged along. They're also affected because of that, but I don't feel like that, your opinion of that first half and the Jack the Ripper murder and the perpetrator, I don't think that's going to change any with the second half. It's a lot of the other characters that get recontextualized because of that. Once again, I don't want to, you might go back and watch it, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody else, so I can't go into any more detail.
No, that's helpful. But, that's helpful. My other question about the ending is, because I think this is based on something. I think it's based on a manga, maybe, or something like that. Do you feel like it wraps up, or is it sort of a, like, you're going to go read this something?
Whether you consider it anticlimactic or not, this story that is being told here is over. Obviously, they have their ups and downs, and they have a big parting at the end of the big climax. But by the end, Holmes and Watson are a duo again and solving crimes in Japan. And, you know, Irene is out there helping them both. So, like, could they do a second season? Certainly. But I feel like this story is over, And it would be like any other Sherlock Holmes that doesn't end with his last bow. That you could always do more Sherlock if you want. It's kind of like Zabungle. It's a hard series. Actually, I'd recommend Zabungle a lot easier. Is that an easy series to recommend? Because it has so many problem parts to it. But I at least admire that it had its very own unique take on the Sherlock Holmes character. Although it does borrow a lot from earlier iterations, it definitely borrows from the BBC. It definitely borrows from the original stories. It does borrow from a few other versions of Sherlock. It does have its own unique elements that aren't just, a pastiche of earlier versions. The second half goes in some unexpected ways. But I feel like the benefits overweigh the negatives, but the negatives are pretty strong. So it's a very soft, very tentative recommendation with maybe you should do a little research, especially if you have certain sensibilities, because I feel like certain things might, especially if you have any kind of like strong feelings about cross-dressing and what do you call it? Not a very Japanese view of that. That would can very easily turn you off instantly. And once again, another thing of like I wouldn't blame you. Some of the comedy is a little crude and definitely out, like not to a modern sensibility.
All right, gang. That is all from us, even though we both have like lists 90 miles long of everything we're rewatching, replaying, rereading, and or new things that we're finally reading, watching, and playing. So this could go on endlessly. We could probably do every podcast for the rest of the year could probably be just projects, and we still would not go through everything that we are all watching because of the situation. So, thanks for joining us on this journey. A lot of like, I don't know, it was really fun to just like a lot of this was exploring things that we had seen before, so that was fun. And picking up on some old shows is always like gives me a good feeling. So, I don't know what we'll talk about next month, but probably another project episode in the future, at least.
That much I could guarantee. I still really want to talk about Violet Evergarden. It's just, I felt like that show's well known enough. I'd rather talk about shows that maybe our audience hadn't watched or like had like 1 million people give their opinion on. But we will see you what we have next month.